You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hi, and welcome to this bonus edition of the Times Higher Education podcast. I'm Sarah Custer, and at the recent Times Higher Education Teaching Excellence Summit at the University of Glasgow, I sat down with our plenary speaker, Richard Arum. He's dean of the University of California, Irvine School of Education and author of Academically Adrift, Limited Learning on College Campuses. In this interview, we talk about how to bridge the attainment gap in higher education learning and the responsibility universities have to develop and maintain the democratic values of society. I started out by asking his opinion about how technology can change the way teaching and researching is occurring. I thought it was quite interesting in your speech this morning. You were talking about some real issues that you have with the traditional debate between research and teaching. And one of them was that technology is making such a huge impact on both of them. Could you expand on that a little bit? And I guess specifically I'm interested in hearing about your thoughts on the pedagogical advances in technology that are happening today and if you think that's going in the right direction.
Right. So, so it's a bit frustrating. Often you hear the statement is made about generals. They're busy thinking and fighting the last war. And I think often in higher education we think about defending and debating moments in the past without fully recognizing how technology is dramatically transforming what it means for students to learn and how the universities of the future will be organized. And as a sociologist, I'm no better than the next person to be able to predict what the future will look like. However, I feel on solid ground saying that technology is changing the way that research is occurring, the way that teaching is occurring, and is going to most definitely change the way universities organize themselves.
I think that's totally true and definitely a given. What about like MOOCs? What about flipped classrooms? What about learning analytics? Is that all going in the right direction in your opinion, or is that just kind of chasing a pipe dream technology for technology's sake?
Yeah, so we're at a period of dramatic experimentation, and so often you see a particular technology deployed, like MOOCs, for example, in a way that's overhyped, oversold. It's going to transform and change everything. 2 years later, we were all wrong. MOOCs are totally unimportant. And so the truth, of course, is that, these things are digital learning, for example, not just MOOCs, because, MOOCs are just the, one particular deployment of that. We also see courseware developed around digital learning. Flipped classrooms, like you said, hybrid settings. All these things are dramatically changing student learning day by day, week by week, semester by semester, year by year. And so the change is happening actually very quickly and dramatically when people look back historically at how things are changing. But you can often deceive yourself when you're in the moment itself to look around and say nothing is really changing. It's all the way it's always been. Let me give you a few examples. So I work at the University of California, Irvine. I'm the dean of the School of Education there. This past year, we offered for the first time a undergraduate course in a traditional format and an online format side by side, kind of competing with each other, if you will.
Was this to compare like a test set?
Well, so I'd like to say it was an evidence-based experimentation, and we're tracking student learning outcomes. We are planning to do a lot of that in the future, actually. But this was in my first year that I occurred there, and so the actual course assigned, the course configurations weren't of my doing. I had inherited them, and so they just had decided to try this out because they had this online version. What was interesting, though, was we found that the online format filled up quicker. And so the students were voting with their feet, if you will, what they saw as kind of most valuable and desirable in terms of their instructional, the instructional formats that they were looking for. And, you know, there's a variety of reasons for that. For one thing, of course, the online options are much more convenient for students that are juggling competing demands, whether that's socializing or extracurricular activities or employment or family. In the case of many of our students, they're living with family and commuting from home. These were seen as the more desirable alternatives. And think back, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, the debates we would have where this was always considered a second-rate opportunity.
Yeah,
that
stigma.
Students,
yeah, there's a big stigma on online learning, right?
Yeah. So again, you know, just as you know, a small evidence that suggests, you know, the way we're thinking about things is not necessarily the same as the way students are thinking about things, and the university itself is changing and transforming. That was the case in the School of Education and the undergraduate coursework, but throughout the university as a whole, there's significant growth in online education, in digital learning, in hybrid courses, in flipped courses. Mm. It's really the format of instruction and student learning is transforming in front of our very eyes. And because it's in front of our very eyes and we're human, we can't always recognize the change.
Yeah, it sounds like you're talking about a bit of a cultural shift in higher education towards accepting online learning as a viable and often more convenient way.
Well, think about this conference itself, right? So we're focusing on teaching excellence is the motto. What if teaching was a way of thinking about student learning from the past? I mean, for one, it assumes that there is a teacher or set of teachers. Many digital learning opportunities in the future, there is no teacher. There's there's a set of curriculum designers, and then various ways that students' work is evaluated, assessed, or where student interests are guided, where they're connected to other resources. Again, I think we make a real mistake thinking about teaching excellence in prior ways that really no longer make sense for the future.
A lot of people say, well, of course researchers have to be teachers because it inspires the students, all the hard work that they're doing. Does there need to be more of a cultural shift by the university and the leadership to show students that it's not always the superstar researcher that is going to give you the best learning experience?
Well, yeah. So again, I would focus on student learning first. And so if you're focusing on student learning rather than teaching, you then start to ask questions, how can a university researcher best support student learning? So one way, perhaps, is that the most powerful connection with a student to improve learning isn't around teaching a course, but is around mentoring and coaching and engaging and involving the undergraduate student in some sort of authentic learning experience, a research apprenticeship or the like. Well, that's a very different way of thinking about we need to beat faculty researchers over the head so that they learn how to teach as well as high school teachers, secondary teachers. They need to be better trained and retrained to be able to provide those services. Another way, as I discussed at length today, is that we need university researchers to conduct research on improving student learning on our campuses. So we have the top social, behavioral, cognitive scientists at many of these major research universities like the one I inhabit. It is indefensible that they are not being organized and deployed to think about student success working to use evidence-based research to iterate on curriculum design, instruction, and improve student learning. Again, we in universities today, we are so quick to call on other organizations, elementary and secondary schools, hospitals, nonprofit organizations, businesses. We lecture them. You need to use evidence-based decision-making. You need to measure, you need to evaluate, you need to assess, you need to iterate, you need to improve design. Well, absolutely, but the day has long passed where we should be doing that to the rest of society and not doing it to our success. Now, think about undergraduate student success. If everyone was passing through at easily and learning at high rates, this wouldn't be a problem. But U.S. higher education, 50% of students don't graduate. 50%. If we had that rate of failure in our secondary schools, it would be defined as a national crisis. Those gaps, 50% non-graduating, have a huge disproportionate impact on students from underrepresented minority groups, from disadvantaged economic backgrounds. And so it's a moral imperative that we work as an institution to address the demands of diverse students in our campuses better. And the best way to do that is to do what we've been advocating for the rest of organizations and society to do, to use evidence-based decision-making, to measure, to evaluate, to improve our performance in an iterative way, and again, to take responsibility for that ourselves, not to look for an accountability system from the state imposed on us to do that for us. You know, no one is asking nonprofit organizations to do these things because of state pressure, state mandates. No one's thinking of businesses doing this because of shareholder demands. You do it because, you know, this is what it means to be a modern organization.
And is that where you mentioned curriculum design, student success? If you could kind of have omnipotent power over implementing this systematic research, looking at higher education teaching, is that where you would begin curriculum development?
So I think that there are three things you could look at in terms of student success. Three obvious things, but there's more than that as well, of course. One would be the most simple: do students progress through and graduate in a timely manner? The second is, do they learn and develop skills and competencies during that time? And the third is, do they have successful transitions to adulthood? And so those are kind of three areas of research within them. When I say transitions to adulthood, I purposely are using a terminology to define it in ways not just around labor market success, but again, assuming responsibilities of adults in our society, which includes exercising democratic citizenship, being not knowledgeable about world affairs, civically engaged, and deliberate in decision making that affects our societies as a whole.
You talked about this just a minute ago, talking about kind of teaching excellence assumes that there is a teacher. The teaching excellence framework was obviously introduced in the UK a couple of years ago. We're having this summit. It's an inaugural summit. Why are we talking about teaching now?
Well, so, a few things. One, universities tend to be faculty-centric places, not student-centric places. And so in terms of a faculty-centric approach, we think of the faculty's role in research and scholarship and the faculty's role in teaching. Like I said, I don't think that's necessarily the right way to think about these problems, particularly around student learning. Why are we having these conversations now? Because if you look at the evidence today, it is overwhelming that we have a serious problem with undergraduate education, with the quality of undergraduate education and undergraduate student success more broadly in terms of graduation, timely graduation, and successful adult transitions. The evidence is overwhelming that this is the case. Partly, it's likely due to the institutions themselves are serving more diverse students, so higher education has expanded dramatically. And so the students that are, we're attempting to educate a very different demographic student composition than colleges and universities attempted to do 20, 30, 40 years ago. And we've been slow to adapt to those changes. And where, again, if you looked at elementary and secondary education, we see that there's been tremendous progress around closing gaps in graduation rates, for example, across groups of students by social background in secondary education. But the gaps are seen dramatically. They reappear in college and university.
Speaking on that point, is by the time they get to university, is it too late, though, for those gaps to be closed?
Well, so it's absolutely the case that prior academic preparation is a strong determinant of undergraduate student success. So that is absolutely correct that there are colleges and universities inherit often challenges that exist from inadequacies in prior education. Nevertheless, as an educator, I believe that all students have the capacity to learn. And so where it might be true, one might want to concede the point that all students might not be able to end up at a particular level. All students can grow and demonstrate progress during 4 years of college. And I think if you look at the evidence, it's pretty overwhelming that by that yardstick, we are failing institutionally because students are not progressing through 4 years of college in the first place. And the second is even those that are making it through 4 years of college, the evidence of significantly developing critical thinking, complex reasoning, writing, these sorts of generic competencies that are useful for the 21st century or past centuries as well, for that matter. Again, the evidence is overwhelming that students are not making as much progress from when they start to when they end college and university. And the failure there has to be put on the institutions themselves. Because again, all students have the ability to grow and develop in a school setting, and it's the school's responsibility to meet those needs. I'd like to add here that I think it's particularly important thinking about these issues today because of the challenging historic moment that we're in internationally, where we see the rise of autocratic governments throughout the world and a movement away from citizens' commitment to democratic values, norms, and principles. And again, in that context, education is the most important thing in creating norms, values, the ability to think critically about the kind of society we want to inhabit and we want our children to inhabit. And so higher education institutions have a responsibility to meet this historic challenge and improve the extent to which the young people that pass through it are developing the ability to serve as a bedrock in the future of our society's commitments to democratic values and norms.
Thanks for listening to this bonus edition of the Times Higher Education Podcast. I'm Sarah Custer, and if you'd like to learn more about the discussions from the Teaching Excellence Summit, you can find all of our coverage on timeshighereducation.com. We'll see you next time.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education Podcast.